Hello and welcome to Radio Rothbard. This is Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor at Mises.org, and with me again is Tho Bishop, my associate editor. And this time we're going to talk a little bit about democracy. I know that among our listeners and readers there's a lot of talk about if democracy is any good at all. We take a little more nuanced view. Democracy can be helpful, can be useful, provided certain conditions are met. And Tho and I are going to talk a little bit about maybe some strategies that could help improve democracy, make it a little less prone to abuse, and help restrain the excesses of the state a little bit more. We'll just cover three parts of that today. In the future, we'll cover some more aspects of it, including populism and how often elections should occur and that sort of thing. But join us for this week, and we'll cover three reasons that democracy must be changed. All right. Well, welcome, Tho.
Thank you. It's going to be a fun episode.
I'd like to get into the weeds a little bit about the nature of democracy. You know, so often we encounter a lot of people, our readers, people commenting, people we meet in real life, who like to denounce democracy in all its aspects. But as we'll talk a little bit here, I mean, all sorts of things get labeled democracy, which are, however, often wildly different in their nature and how they actually manifest themselves in politics. And this has reached even some extreme lengths where, remember when Donald Trump was elected and it became clear that people in the FBI and what we call the deep state were conspiring against him, and people calling themselves libertarians were actually out there saying, well, democracy's terrible, so I'm glad the deep state is taking over the U.S. government. I'd rather be ruled by the FBI than have democratic elections. And needless to say, I found that bizarre and eye-rolling and silly, but I guess when you obsess over the idea that democracy is terrible and the root of all of our troubles, that you end up coming to conclusions like that. But I don't think it by itself is necessarily the root of all our troubles. There's probably a lot of other factors at work. And there's maybe some things that can be done to limit those excesses that we've identified. But let's start with one topic that is probably the most controversial and least popular among the ones that we've often promoted on Mises.org, and that's the concept of limiting the franchise, that is, limiting people who can vote. Now, of course, historically, anyone who criticizes this viewpoint is quick to bring up old shibboleths like limiting the vote based on totally arbitrary standards like, are you a woman or are you black? And of course, in the past, these were used to preserve the power of certain groups. But this isn't based on any real objective standard at all, right? In that by no means is it universal to women that they are a damage to the cause of liberty and limiting government power. And the same with any other racial or ethnic group. And so really, if you're wanting to limit the franchise, you got to come up with some sort of actual objective standard there. And some of the objective standards we've explored in the past are things like, if you're a government employee, should you still be able to vote? Maybe that's that's some sort of conflict of interest, right? If you are earning a living based on tax income, then maybe you shouldn't be voting on how taxes are spent. And then expanding that a little bit, the issue of, are you a net taxpayer at all? Even if you're not a government employee, what if overall you make your living from government spending? Say you build highways and you're a government contractor, or say you've been on welfare your whole life and the amount of taxpayer-funded monies you have collected far outnumbers the amount you've actually paid into taxes. Now, of course, applications might be difficult determining exactly who's in which category. I could see being a problem. But what do you think of this conceptually?
The other value here is that, you know, as someone who, if anyone follows me on social media, I can kind of sometimes fall in that camp of, you know, taking a good pot shot here and there at the D word. And I do think that there is a value there in kind of like a, you know, when we're trying to make a broader kind of cultural critique, right? We're trying to, you know, it's shocking in today's world to criticize democracy, right? It's held up as if, oh, well, this is so self-evidently proper. This is, you know, being against democracy is being against the American way itself, right? And it's like, you know, there's something that you can enjoy kind of taking that, you know, that Mencken sort of curmudgeon, all the people are idiots. And so this democratic process of the rewards stupidity. And so, you know, when we start talking about, and obviously, again, there are issues with any sort of government structure that exists, and each one have their strengths and their weaknesses. So when you talk about limiting the franchise, then you kind of get that similar sort of you know, rush of being the touching on taboo topics that can sometimes, I think, foment, in the right circles at least, some serious discussions, because we're going beyond simply the platitudes of like a middle school civics. And I think that's always kind of a starting point for like a serious conversation, particularly in today's kind of mimetic, scripted world of political discourse. So when we look at ways of limiting the franchise, I mean, I think that the government employee one is something that I think, you know, start looking at incentive structures. Again, obviously, if you have the ability to vote yourself a ways to erase the ability to vote yourself job protection, right? I mean, I think that even the most sacrosanct view of democracy can acknowledge, okay, like there's some issues there. And what's interesting is you know, this has kind of been, you know, a historical discussion, right? Looking at, oh, well, the virtues of property ownership. Again, I think that was kind of a beautifully simplistic approach to voting rights, right? If you have a longstanding interest in the community that you're living in, you're not just kind of a fly-by-night carpetbagger. You know, you actually have that is an incentive structure right there that rewards you know, thinking in the long run, which I think that there's a lot of benefits there throughout social decision making. You know, that's something that I think plays something that we should look at. But now, when you have kind of a normalization of going the other way. With, you know, you have Kamala Harris trying to treat as a valid argument that, oh, we should be extending the franchise down to people that are 16 and older, because, oh, shouldn't they have a say in the way society is governed? You know, clearly you see people that see a political value in weaponizing younger voters that tend to have a certain viewpoint. And so I think that it makes these sort of conversations on, you know, what really should it mean to be a voter in a democracy? What is being, what mechanisms are there to make these sort of decisions on governance? You know, it pushes it into a relevant conversation that perhaps it has not been in quite a while, and in a mainstream setting.
Well, and of course, historically, we have many examples of this. In recent centuries, always moving in the direction of expanding the franchise. In the U.S., of course, this happened during the Jacksonian period, where they attained universal male suffrage, and also in a gradual way in the United Kingdom in the 19th century. You had reform movements in the 1830s, the 1860s, and the 1880s. In each case, you had the franchise being expanded lower and lower down the socioeconomic scale. So in the past, access to parliament and to the vote was very carefully restricted to people who were seen as the genteel ruling class, in many cases the aristocracy. And then in the 1830s, with the backing of the liberals and the Whigs, you had then an expansion to middle class people and to anyone who had a household whose net worth was reached a certain point of, I believe, £10. And that was expanded a little bit, and it really expanded the vote then to these large industrial cities, which were a new burgeoning power in England at the time. It had been much more concentrated to just certain rural areas where the aristocracy dominated, or to London itself. And then that moved even further down to the working classes and so on in the 1860s and 1880s. And so the question was always, why should we give these people the power to vote? How will this affect the overall political landscape? And will they use the vote then to favor themselves? And Mises talks about this in Bureaucracy. It's the issue of in Europe, many countries are crossing the threshold, he noted, into where the people who produce the tax revenue are going to be outnumbered by the people who feed off of the tax revenue, government employees or people who make a living off government spending and so on. And Mises worried that, well, once you reach that point, then you can simply forget about any sort of fiscal responsibility. So it would seem that it's really, if you're going to have a democracy, you have to grapple with this idea of determining who's going to be voting, and are they just going to simply throw caution to the wind? Is it going to become a system where the net taxpayers are simply exploited by a larger number of people who live off that slightly smaller group? And unless you're willing to really explicitly talk about that, it would seem that a democratic system just goes further and further down that road of exploitation of a productive minority by a slightly larger majority.
That's why I think this couples directly into kind of this larger trend in, at least, kind of American politics with kind of the progressive era and onward, of seeing politics in the state itself, you know, kind of deifying it, right? You know, this American civic religion, and I think you see this now when, you know, there's conversations about it's not simply 16-year-olds. I think that's just a kind of particularly self-evidently absurd idea out there. But you know, there's been several states, including Florida here, that have been expanding voting rights to felons, which had traditionally been they had been limited in their ability to vote outside of some sort of process, you know, more strict process in regaining those rights. You see it. There's conversations about whether immigrants or even illegal immigrants should have the ability to vote. I think there's some localities in California that have expanded it there. And so when you deify the state and you think that participation is itself the justification for state authority, then voting becomes this natural right. I don't know if they quite use those words, but you know, they see that as every bit as important as the right to defend yourself. And I think that goes directly to, you know, when you have this skepticism within libertarians and conservatives about democracy and its context, I think it is a reflection of, again, this deification of the state, this cathedral, to use a popular term out there, of, you know, seeing the state as a means of bringing this utopian on earth. And I think that's kind of, you know, those are some of the underpinnings of this larger conversation. That's why it's important to separate this, right? Democracy is a mechanism for trying to figure out, what are the social structures that we should be dealing with? You know, what are these institutions that deal with the law making and enforcement process? It's not something to be worshipped. And I think that, we talk about government-run schools and things like that. There's a lot of incentives to seeing democracy in the state itself as something beyond simply the enforcement of property rights and laws and kind of that night watchman state that Mises saw. And obviously, you know, Rothbardians and anarchists and private governance would kind of reject that entirely. And so, again, it's the two go hand in hand to this question.
Well, that brings us to our second topic a bit, is this issue of decentralizing democracy. As you note, there's this certain worshipful posture given toward democracy in general, but it seems to go specifically in the direction of deifying the overall democratic mass. And we see this, for example, in the Electoral College. So it's not acceptable, we're told, that a president is chosen by 50 state elections plus some other territories, that in each case they choose a winner, and then those 50 elections then determine who's the president. We're told that's no good. You have to have one giant election, and it's that popular vote that should really determine who the president is. And so it's this issue of, we have to have not just democracy, but a giant centralized democratic mass that makes all the decisions. And on the contrary, historically, decentralizing democracy has actually been a key element in limiting the power of the state. And we see this in a couple of different examples. Obviously, it is the Electoral College is one. We see that we just don't let all American votes be equal. We recognize that different parts of the country have different interests, and that if you just have one large mass, you could have one single part of the country or a couple regions of the country, that so long as they have a large number of people, could then repeatedly outvote another part of the country. So specifically, of course, in its modern manifestations, but historically as well, you have less populated rural areas of the country get consistently outvoted by more populous urban areas. Now, it's really, in reality, not just a difference of urban versus rural or urban versus suburban. These people have different values. They often have different religions. They're dominated by different ethnic groups and so on. So you have real demographic differences between these groups. And if you insist on just one large voting mass, then you end up with what is essentially a permanent minority within that, which in the end has no voice. And this is the problem with the one man, one vote scenario. And we can see this in foreign examples, especially. So in the case of Russia, as the Soviet Union was collapsing and the Baltics were trying to leave, so the Baltic states being Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, they all said, we want out. We want out of Russia. We want to have our own independent country. A lot of quote-unquote pro-democracy people at the New York Times were saying, no, no, all those little countries should all stay together and democracy will help them all get along. The reality, of course, was that if you were a Baltic state still within the Russian Federation, you would be outvoted every time. There was no way that handful of a few million people in the Baltics could possibly have their voice heard within a much larger country. And so in the U.S., you have a similar sort of thing going, where if you had one fairly unpopulous region versus, say, California, they're just going to be outvoted every time. And so how is that democracy working if there's just a permanent, unheeded minority group that can't make any of its voices heard?
Absolutely. And you know, the more that democracy is centralized, the more it always empowers whoever that ruling class is. I mean, they tend to be the biggest benefactors. And this is true. I mean, obviously, we can kind of see this, I think, play out when we talk about the Electoral College and population centers and how much power, you know, like I think like the 10 largest cities would basically be able to dominate the rest politically. But it's even true in smaller examples. For example, like here where I live in Florida, our county commission, the entire county votes on your county commissioners rather than having the individual district's residents vote on their representatives in county government. And so the people that really like that are like the, you know, for lack of a better word, like the good old boy system that has a lot of campaign mechanisms in place. Like they're really, you know, they're pros at winning elections. It becomes a skill set in itself. They've got all the vendors that do the science and whatever. They've got the whole thing. And so that gives them a big upper hand in putting in place the, you know, whoever they want in elected office. Whereas if you break that up and you kind of really localize even that local government election, it's a lot easier to go out and meet all your neighbors than it is to meet your entire county. And so again, this isn't simply on a national scale within a country the size of America, which is obviously uniquely large. I mean, I think it even plays down to the most local level. But again, and Mises talked about this a lot. Like that's why when people talk about Mises' political ideas on a variety of things, that there's a lot more nuance than they typically try to depict him as. I mean, he was believed in the economic advantages to immigration and things like this. But he noted that when you have an interventionist government, get a government that goes far beyond that night watchman minimalist state, you have this insidious structure there where you can weaponize certain parts of the nation against the minority, and that this creates social conflict in ways that, again, simply having a vote in the system and the virtues that he saw democracy brought and the ability of changing over political regimes and bringing in new ideas rather than having to, you know, to behead the king and some of the historical brutality that came with non-democratic structures, that, you know, if you have an interventionist state, if you have if you don't respect that right to political self-determination and that secessionist being able to break away from the larger polity that he thought was so vital to making democracy this great and liberal thing, then it's very easy to be abused. And so I think you're seeing this play out, I think, again, right now with the concern, you know, the movement of the left trying to get rid of the Electoral College, these last little restraints to that centralized power. Again, I mean, you can even see like a state like New York, if you see, I think it was like the attorney general's race in 2018, like New York City voted for one candidate, the rest of the state voted for someone else, and the New York City candidate wins. Just been the power, the population power of that one city alone. Like, this isn't a representation of people actually choosing who represents them or the government that they have. It is just simply, you know, democratic imperialism. If you don't respect that decentralized political self-determination mechanism there.
Yeah, of course, we see that a lot at the state level because states aren't federal. So it's just basically whoever gets 50% plus one in a gubernatorial race wins. There's no sort of method of decentralizing those votes once you get down to the state level, like at the federal level. And I've noted in the past, I want to see this decentralization take place far beyond just the presidential election. There should be some sort of electoral college, if you will, where if they want to pass a tax increase, for example, in Congress, they should have to get a widespread number of votes from all regions of the country as well. So you can imagine how that would go down, right? Oh, we want to increase the capital gains tax, so now we have to submit it to the states, and the states all have their own independent vote on whether this should be approved. And it would become much more difficult then for one part of the country that benefits from a tax increase to then impose that tax increase on some other part of the country. Now, the Swiss have a way of dealing with this. They use double majorities, which is a scheme where if you have, say, a constitutional change, it has to be approved not only by a majority of the Swiss population, but also a majority of the Swiss cantons, which are basically the Swiss version of the states. So you can imagine how that would work in the U.S., right? Oh, we want to change tax law. So that's got to be passed by not only a majority vote, say, in Congress or even the total population, but also 26 states have to approve it. So you can see how much more easy it would be to kill terrible legislation or legislation that benefited one region or one demographic group that was maybe concentrated in one area over another. And the U.S. method of constitutional amendments, of course, uses this as well, where you need two-thirds majorities in Congress, and you need, what is it, I think 3/4 majority of states to approve it. And, I mean, that's built in, because they understand you can't just have majority vote on these things. This could lead to great imbalances in representation. But we never, for whatever reason, the left has decided they hate all that. I guess because the left represents more the large, tightly packed urban centers, where they've decided that they can win these large popular votes. And so decentralization through any sort of double majority or electoral college becomes something of the enemy. And so we've been told that this is somehow undemocratic, although it's totally unclear why, say, 50 state elections is somehow less democratic than one big, giant national elections. I mean, by what definition of democracy is that the case? But that seems to be the left's position right now.
And I think that goes directly to, you know, kind of this rising kind of new right. Andrew Breitbart's, you know, famous quote about, politics being downstream from culture. You know, again, within at least in American context, you know, there has been this recognition that there's been this people have recognized, right, that the left's control of culture, academia, media, pushing certain narratives gives them a significant upper hand in dealing with broad majority votes in the long term. At least that's the perception there, right? And that I think that fuels a lot of the skepticism and concern about democracy and the D word in general amongst the right. Because again, if you simply think that, oh, you can motivate and influence the masses, you know, where you get that 50 plus one, then you can do all sorts of things that you can't get when you have perhaps a smaller electorate, or you have a more within a kind of a more decentralized framework. But yeah, it's interesting the difference between, and it's not just simply constitutional amendments at the federal level. I know Florida, I think you have to have a 60% threshold for constitutional amendments. But there has been pushback in Florida on this mechanism here because basically, I mean, people have realized that voters kind of largely pass almost anything kind of put in front of them. And so they've been trying to rein in constitutional amendment process because, you know, there's not a lot of vetting that goes into kind of these, you know, particularly, you know, confusingly worded, vague constitutional amendments that kind of, they end up being rubber stamped. And one of the things that I think is creates kind of an interesting device in looking at kind of these political arrangements, actually, is kind of fantasy football. I'm a commissioner of several leagues. And what I've learned is that if I have something that I really kind of want to get done, and I know there's a few members of the league that are going to kind of fight me on it, then I'll just call for a big vote because I know most of the league doesn't care. I can just kind of give them the rubber stamp whatever I want. And so there's all sorts of ways that, you know, once you kind of recognize that most people aren't inherently political, they don't want to argue about these sort of things, by simply expanding the electorate and allowing for a 50+1 way of making rules, you can get all sorts of things through. And again, so I think this goes directly to kind of this desire from people. It's not about, it's about, you know, what's the underlying agenda beyond simply the genuine belief of political self-determination, again, which is why the two kind of go hand in hand with a rejection of any sort of decentralized political authority.
Yeah, and I think next, when we do an episode in the future on populism, I think that's something we'll have to look at, right? Is if you give votes, like referenda votes, to the general public, do they tend to approve those things or do they tend to oppose them? I think it depends on who you talk to as to what the thinking on that is. But you could imagine if that was done at the federal level, right? We want a federal tax increase. Let's let the population vote on it in each state. Are they going to be inclined to approve that or not? That's an empirical question, I suppose, and one that... we don't have the answer to, since it hasn't happened enough times to come up with any sort of general theory about. But yes, that's something that needs to be asked. And if the answer is no, that the voters just tend to approve anything, then maybe that's not an effective tool in terms of using democracy against those sorts of things. But I guess that's still debatable.
Well, it's also just, you know, like the timing of certain elections. I mean, I think often, like around here, and I know there's going to be, you know, things will differ depending on where you're at. But like here, the municipal elections are never at the same time as general elections, right? So you know, these are elections that you really have to go out of your way to vote on. And again, when you consider the amount of contracts and a lot of the favors that you can get from local government. Again, I don't think that this is a coincidence, and I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing either. I'm like, there's definitely pros and cons to all of this. Again, there's no perfect formula where if you hold an election just the right way, it justifies whatever the state's going to do. And that's when we analyze the state based on what it does, not based on the authority that the public gives to it. And but yeah, you see, like, there's definitely, yeah, you see the different mechanisms in the way that different elections play. Typically, like, there's an underlying reasoning there that, again, it's not always the most benign.
Well, that takes us a little bit back to Mises's views. And certainly we should note, right, as you brought up a little bit, that Mises was very much a Democrat, a small D Democrat, thought democracy was a useful tool, but also at the same time was in favor of federalism in the sense of, if you're going to have a state, it was best to have self-government, self-determination at some sort of local level. And you can see this, he spoke well of this as it, to the extent that it existed within the Austrian Empire or Austria-Hungary of his day. He thought it was a good thing that you had these different ethnic groups or parts of the empire that had some degree of self-government outside the reach of the centralized Austrian government. And then he also has an interesting paper published in the 40s, and we published it on Mises.org. It's not exactly a Rothbardian paper, but it's an interesting examination of Mises' views, where Mises suggests, if for the purposes of defense against a much larger Soviet Union, you might have this union of Eastern European states. But it was essential, Mises said, that if you did have this union, say, of Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and maybe a couple other Eastern European countries, that each of those member states maintained almost total self-government within its own borders, and that the only common government covered foreign affairs. And this is very Jeffersonian in its view. But it's clear that he thought any sort of mass voting union-wide was unworkable and would end up violating the rights of, say, the Hungarians in order to favor the Poles and so on. And I think that same concept then works at the level of the United States as well. Certainly that was the belief of many early Americans and framers and so on. And that brings us to our third topic, though, and that's just the issue of member states of some sort of confederation or union really choosing their own terms in terms of who can vote and how they're represented. And one example of this is the issue of the 17th Amendment. And I noticed recently Senator Sass, I think that's how you say his name, was arguing we should repeal the 17th Amendment. Now, this comes up every few years, and I note, though, that you and I have both in real life encountered people who come up and say this, that all our problems will be solved if we repeal the 17th Amendment and the Constitution will go back to how it was intended. And I think that greatly overstates the power of the solution, but I do see the value of allowing states to choose their senators or their representation as states in Washington on their own terms. Now, I don't think repealing the 17th Amendment on its own would do that, because just to repeal it would then send a state back to being mandated by the Constitution to pick them through the legislature. But maybe some states would pick them through a statewide vote. Maybe some would pick them through the legislature. Maybe some would pick them just by being appointed by the governor. Who knows? Or there's any number of ways you could do it. But it would seem to me to make sense that as a state, if it's going to send delegates in the Senate, which seems to be the original purpose of the Senate, was that the state governments themselves would be represented there, that it should be up to the state itself to determine who votes in that election or who's determining the senator, so that the states as states have representation. But rather than dictating to them how that's chosen, thinking along the lines of maybe Mises' scheme for his Eastern European Union and so on, that membership, like in any loose confederation, should come down to how each member itself wants to be represented.
I think there's kind of this Tea Party aesthetic of like rediscovering forgotten wisdom of the founders, and you know, it kind of couples into the belief that the Constitution was kind of this perfected, God-given document. And I understand why there's a lot of respect and love and admiration for the Constitution. I also understand the Rothbardian, more cynical view there. I'd much rather take that Tea Party aesthetic than like kind of the progressive aesthetic that a lot of conservatives embraced, particularly during the Bush years. You know, the problem is that there is a lack of kind of really looking at the real history here, because it's not as if America was, was this great. You didn't have a lot of tremendous kind of state checks on growing federal power prior to the 17th Amendment, right? I mean, obviously, slavery was one of the big issues that tended to really kind of agitate some of those actions. But I mean, you had a lot of states that just weren't fulfilling Senate positions, that, you know, it wasn't this great, perfect, foolproof mechanism in there that kind of kept D.C. where it was at. And of course, it reflected in the fact that, yeah, as soon as the ink was barely dry in the Constitution before the Federalists were trying to run over all the restraints on there to begin with. And so, yeah, I mean, that itself isn't going to solve things. States should have the ability to figure out their own political arrangements here. And I think that goes back to looking at democracy as a mechanism and not something that is a religious-like power. But one of the things that I one of the articles out there, not to come off as being too much of a kiss-up here, but like your article on anarchism and radical decentralization as being the same thing, I think is one of the most important articles that we've published on kind of political theory in recent years, kind of going into what Mises is really talking about and looking at democracy within these smaller units and showing the compatibility with kind of Rothbardian anarchism and obviously Rothbard's Nations by Consent being greatly demonstrating what he was kind of responding to, seeing the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that's one of the articles out there that I'd recommend to everyone reading to go kind of deeper on this topic, because local control, decentralized democracy, these are very interesting concepts that kind of go beyond simply default libertarian talking points that I think not only improve your own way of looking at governance and the mechanisms of governing, but can perhaps be a little bit more persuasive to others that are genuinely interested in trying to improve, you know, the mess that we have in modern, in local politics in general in this country. And I think that sort of, you know, whenever you're actually able to reach out to other people and talk about things, you know, that is a good thing, I think, in general.
Well, of course, I agree that decentralization is extremely important here. And I think then it's important to note, right, is that there is no inherent conflict then between democratic mechanisms and decentralization. The left has tried to convince people that you need centralized democracy, where everything is decided in these big nationwide elections and so on. But there's no reason why you couldn't have more elections, more locally focused elections that are designed to really promote the views and provide vetoes for very specific localized groups, whether at a state level or maybe even at a county level or at a municipal level and so on, and providing more power then for those groups as maybe members within a larger confederation. And I think that's what's really been lost. And I think that's why people cling maybe to the 17th Amendment issue, is they see that at some point in the past, the 17th Amendment ruined this earlier vision that states for themselves would determine what their representation would be, and that the idea being that in the Senate, the states taken as a whole would have their interests represented in Washington, and that Congress would be seen more as a grouping of states rather than as representatives of the people overall. So in a sense, yep, I get it. Before the 17th Amendment, there seemed to have been more decentralization. But I'm not sure that even that was sufficient. I've suggested that really they actually messed up on the way it was written before the 17th Amendment, that really states should only have one vote in the Senate. So that, because when you had two votes and they could cancel each other out from each state, it kind of gave the impression that representation in the Senate was really just up to the persons who were representing the state. And their views may or may not have represented the state, which if you were having two votes in each state canceling each other out, then really what were the interests of the state? And could they be represented in the Senate? And so maybe it was better than to have just one vote per delegation in the Senate, and that would be very different. So maybe if you're all hot on the idea of repealing the 17th Amendment, maybe you want to go farther than that and make sure that there's really only one vote that each state can cast in the Senate, so that that then becomes a reflection of what it is that the state's trying to do within Congress itself. Of course, the idea that whatever, that the senator is getting its marching orders from the state government somehow, that's not always necessarily going to be the case. But I think it would be a little more clear to communicate the idea that the job of the Senate was to reflect the views of the states as states rather than as representatives of congressional districts or of the U.S. population as a whole.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that one vote per state thing, but I think you're right. That would have improved that a great deal, because it's interesting, because if you know, when you look at throughout American history, you know, obviously early on, and it kind of gets to some of, I think, you know, Rothbard's, you know, conversation about nationalism, even in its own way. You know, when you have, you know, when once upon a time, you had states kind of view themselves as their own country, right? I mean, Jefferson in particular is often referred to, you know, Virginia as his country. But you did have states even early on where the kind of the divides there were not about the interests of the state itself per se, but it was about kind of larger political machinations. And so that sort of romantic idea that the state itself would simply reflect, you know, the intricacies and the self-interest of that collective unit, rather than these larger political machinations, this partisanship. You know, I think perhaps that rise and that solidification of that two-party system perhaps kind of undermined some of those original intents within that, you know, Madisonian Federalist structure in ways that, you know, that's why by the time we got to the 17th Amendment, you know, it really wasn't that great fix then that, again, that so many, in particular, kind of modern Tea Party people kind of saw as a great solution to the problems that we face today.
Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Next time, Tho and I will be back and we'll talk about populism. And while today we talked about limiting the franchise, maybe having more voters out there, having more active voters actually is a good restraint, even in big nationwide contests. And it's still debatable, still being debated even among Tho and myself as whether that's a good thing. And the whole Trump phenomenon has certainly made it all the more relevant. So hopefully you'll join us for next time when we talk about that. But until then, thank you for listening to Radio Rothbard and have a wonderful day.